Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In 2020, everything is partisan. Policing, education, health insurance, religious freedom, and now public health guidelines. How did we get here, and how is partisan politics impacting the U.S. battle with COVID-19? Lisa Hager is an assistant professor of political science at South Dakota State University. David Wiltsey is an associate professor of political science at SDSU, and they're joining us today for a monthly check-in and conversation. Dr. Hager, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Dr. Wiltsey, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to start out with this idea of where people are taking their cues from, and had an interesting conversation over the weekend with someone who had clearly been getting information from a place that was far different from where I was getting my information, and we had to sit and unpack, how do you know that? Why do you think that? So which one of you wants to start here with this idea of how do we get so divided and polarized that we don't even have the same information about something where the stakes are so high as this disease?
Yeah,
well, I can start.
I'm sorry. That's my fault. Lisa, you go ahead.
Well, so, you know, kind of what I was thinking is just the fact that we live in this, you know, information age where you really can get information from anywhere. So whether that's from a news source like SDPB or online or on TV like a CNN, but also it can be something like a social media post. And if you're not someone who really digs into the information that you're reading and maybe even does some fact checking at times, you know, you may be getting information that's not entirely factual. But I think in general, when we start thinking about where people are getting their information from, you know, it's anything like the media, but then they're also taking cues from state and federal politicians who have the same partisan affiliation and same political viewpoints as them. So essentially what I'm saying is we see people picking up news but viewing it from a more partisan filter at times.
Yeah, and leadership matters. We might be looking at the news in a traditional news source or a non-traditional information source, but we're also looking to people that we admire or maybe who we voted for, people that we're listening to. We're taking cues from them as well. David, what did you want to add to that sort of, you know, kickoff question of how polarization is really changing the information that we get?
Yeah, we've seen two concurrent trends when it comes to some of the broader broader political identities and the way in which we perceive ourselves within a media environment. We lack that common experience that we had 30, 40 years ago with a very few media outlets, just like with what Lisa was saying, and now we have this smorgasbord of outlets that we can choose from to reinforce whatever beliefs we have. But we've also seen a very serious polarization and sorting within the parties. The parties 30, 40 years ago were a lot more mixed. There was a lot more variation within the within the two parties than there are now when it comes to ideology. And with these two things working together and reinforcing one another, we have two entirely different experiences as people are consuming media and thinking about how politics is unfolding and what their positions are on any given political issue.
I want to start with the pandemic response and the federal government, because even recently we're seeing if you're tracking, you know, the White House response to the pandemic, it can be confusing because now the president and his advisors are pointing out why Dr. Fauci was wrong, things that he said that they feel were misleading early on. Dr. Fauci is calling that bizarre. And this is the whole team. This is the team of people who meet on the coronavirus White House task force. So even at that level, if you were taking your cues from the beginning from that task force, you might be pretty confused right now with what's happening. Lisa, what's going on, you know, in the White House with some of the division and the, you know, the criticism of Fauci and his response to the president?
Yeah, so I think right now what we're seeing is the president being frustrated essentially with this pandemic because we're seeing a lot of discussion about how we need to get the economy up and running. And this stems a lot from Congress trying to continue to respond to COVID and make decisions regarding things like, do we extend the unemployment subsidy, for instance. And so from the Trump administration standpoint, where he ran on a very economy-heavy platform in 2016, he's looking at the importance of getting that economy up and running. And then associated with that is also making sure that students are going back to school at all levels, physically, in person, not anything where they're doing it online and at home. And so he's kind of becoming more insular in the types of information that he wants to use going forward to make these sorts of decisions. And this isn't really anything that is just occurring in the United States even. So we see that in some of the other countries throughout the world where you have male leaders who are, you know, really kind of looking at some epidemiological modeling and talking to their personal advisors rather than really inviting quite a few people to the table that maybe even have dissenting viewpoints and making a decision in light of that. And that's something that we have seen women presidents and prime ministers throughout the world doing, inviting more people to the table and really trying to make a decision based on all of the information that they're getting, even if it doesn't always agree with each other.
David, Dr. Fauci told interviewers with Atlantic Magazine that he's no longer meeting with the president on a daily basis, but he did say he was talking to the vice president on a daily basis, and the vice president is presumably briefing the president. But expand a little bit on what Lisa said about just, you know, when there is a problem, even the information might not, you know, President Trump might not hear directly from Dr. Fauci. He might hear it filtered through Vice President Pence. And what does that mean for the overall response to the pandemic? It changes, it, you know, is it just a quirk that's happening internally, or does it have the potential to really change policy and change people's lives?
Well, this president and the way he's run his administration, the way he's structured his White House, has always been very fractured, very chaotic. They've never had, the kind of discipline within their ranks to really hold to a message and to just communicate these sorts of things effectively. And that's really just kind of an outgrowth of his managerial style. A lot of us have, long been saying, when we have a real crisis, this could be very problematic, because you're right. He does tend to cloister himself. He does tend to isolate himself from people who have dissenting opinions from his own. He's pushing aside expertise on a regular basis. And for whatever reason, this particular crisis was politicized from the start here in the United States. And this is, just in stark contrast to what we've seen happen in Europe and in many other countries around the world, where professional bureaucracies have played a close advisory role with political leadership. And the political leadership has largely been deferring to that kind of expertise. And we just haven't seen that here. We haven't seen that kind of reliance upon expertise within our public health structures that have led to effective response elsewhere.
Does this sort of feed into this idea of cognitive dissonance, Lisa, in the sense that, we hear one thing or we look up the CDC guidelines, and then in the state of South Dakota, we look around and we say, but we can go to see professional bull riders, or we can go to an event at Mount Rushmore, so therefore it must be okay, but yet we're also thinking it doesn't, and it can be, people can be very confused and they can be angry at people for wearing masks or not wearing masks. How much does it impact us here in South Dakota, Lisa? And I'm specifically wondering about how kind of confused people can be about the whole matter.
Right. And I think part of that stems from the fact that outside of Sioux Falls and some of the hotspot issues that they've had there, those of us in rural South Dakota or even smaller communities haven't been touched personally as much by COVID as others in Sioux Falls or even in larger metropolitan areas like New York and elsewhere. And so you do naturally start to say, well, there's currently this threat, and I understand that there is, you know, precautions that need to take place, but when you are also realizing that the number of cases is fairly low and you see this particular pandemic being politicized, yeah, you start to get confused and maybe not know up from down in that particular instance. You know, I think some of the things that we're seeing recently, though, is that a lot of personal choices regarding masks and whatnot is really being taken out of the hands of the average citizen. So we saw Montana's governor, for instance, instituting a mask policy for anybody who's going out to a public place because they were seeing their number of cases increase. You know, just this week we see Walmart, Sam's Club requiring their customers to wear masks. So as this pandemic continues on and as we see cases rising, I see more people not even really getting a choice on what they're going to do regarding some of the information they are getting. It's if you want to go to Walmart, you need to wear a mask.
On the 4th of July.
Yeah, this is a classic
No, go ahead, David.
Yeah, this is just a classic collective action problem. And when your default is to rely upon individuals making choices, and those choices are just not congruent with overall public health, and they're based on these cues that people are taking from a White House and a government in general that has been very mixed and very confusing, it's not surprising that we have such wide variation in terms of people's opinions of masks and willingness to put on a mask when they go into a public space. And this is why we have government in times like this, where you have these collective action problems, where individuals making choices are going to be detrimental to the overall public good because we're not properly incented as individuals to think about the public good in the way that other countries are responding to this with these kinds of mandates.
I want to talk about the non-aggression principle because there are a whole lot of people who are not identifying as Republicans or as Democrats. Maybe they're libertarian and they're looking at this whole role of government. And there's been talk, especially in libertarian circles, about the non-aggression principle and any, you know, forceful interference. And they're relating it to wearing masks. And David, I'm wondering if you have thoughts on sort of how libertarians or people who are dissatisfied with government response. You know, on one hand, we're hearing no one can make me wear a mask, and then others are, you know, this is a violation of my personal freedom, and others are saying this is basically not making other people sick, which is the one role of government, is to prevent this kind of aggression. Any thoughts on the sort of libertarian viewpoint of mask wearing?
Well, that's a very rudimentary understanding of individual rights and personal liberty, where, you know, you have this absolutist understanding of this whole package of rights. And the whole reason we have government is to overcome these kinds of collective action problems, including the protection of basic rights. I'm not incented to really defend your right to free speech or somebody else's right to a fair trial or whatever any of these things are. We form government to protect ourselves from these sorts of problems and to secure these rights. And to have this kind of, you know, and the first amongst these rights is the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And it is the role of government to protect its citizens' rights and its their lives. And this is one of those cases where the aggregation of our individual actions just doesn't protect, doesn't give us the protection that we need. And we need government to come in and, you know, mandate this 8-10 square inches of cloth or paper over a person's mouth and nose. And if, you know, if this is the right that, or if this is your understanding of liberty, and this is, you know, the the height of government intrusion, I really got to question that kind of a value set where, you know, you see all these other rights out there in the world and all these other injustices in the world, and you focus it all on this little mask. I mean, this it boggles my mind how people can take such a simplistic and absolutist understanding to personal liberty to avoid wearing this little piece of protective gear.
Yeah,
Before I let you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to pivot quickly before we run out of time to this data sharing agreement with the state of South Dakota to the federal government about driver's license data. And let's talk a little bit about how this has a potential to impact the people whose data is being shared. Lisa, would you like to start with the data sharing agreement that we now know more about between the state of South Dakota and the federal government?
Right. So essentially what's going on is you have states like South Dakota, but also Iowa, Nebraska, and South Carolina that I saw agreeing to share driver's license information and also information from state identification cards with the Census Bureau. And so essentially what is going on is there's this attempt to understand what the proportion of citizens are, you know, those who are also residing in the country legally but are not citizens, and then also to eventually try to also get a sense of how many undocumented individuals do we have living here in the United States. And so essentially what's happening is the Census Bureau is trying to pull a bunch of different public records. So even like the Department of Homeland Security has agreed to supplement some of this data to really start kind of digging into, you know, what is that proportion of those three groups of people within the country, which has some implications for the redistricting of congressional districts.
Professor Wiltsie, anything you wanted to add to that? And specifically, I'm wondering if it can go beyond congressional districts to the Census Bureau sharing information back with the states for state legislative districts. Does that happen also?
Yeah, that you know, the same data is used for state legislative districts, which obviously in South Dakota, that's the most important because we don't have federal districts. But, you know, I question the sincerity and, you know, what this is truly going to be used for. This administration has, in several instances, sent out these signals through these sorts of initiatives, whether it be the voter fraud initiative and other initiatives that are threatening to crack down on some aspect of immigration in particular here. I think for a lot of you know, for the better part of this initiative, it's more about sending out these signals that they're taking immigration and immigration reform seriously, that they want to crack down on illegal immigration, tighten legal immigration. And also, you have to look at it from the perspective of the states who are sharing this, the politicians there. It's no coincidence that these are all states that are run by Republicans who are very close to the president, and all are kind of in a national conversation for positions in the next administration, should that happen. And, you know, this is how the president responds, and this is who he looks favorably upon when it comes to these sorts of jobs. So we do see some key people getting close to the president with probably an eye on national appointed positions.
Lisa Hager and David Wiltsie are both professors at South Dakota State University in the Political Science Department. Lisa, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
David, thanks as well.
Thanks.